Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. We have the greatest hour lined up. I'm so excited. I have it titled as The History and Mysteries of Disney. That's what I have. Our guest today, Professor Carmenita Higginbotham. She's at the UVA McIntyre Department of Art. Professor Higginbotham joined the faculty in 2005. She has many publications, papers, and film contributions, including a documentary on Walt Disney and an article on Michael Eisner, former CEO of the Walt Disney Company. Her most recent book, The Urban Scene, Race, Reginald Marsh, and American Art, examines early 20th century American art. And Professor Higginbotham regularly teaches courses at UVA, Art and Film, African-American Art, American Film Noir, plus two courses on Disney and Heroes, Superheroes, and American Visual Culture. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
I'm so excited.
Oh, that's good to hear.
I've never done a show. I think I've been doing this program, not always at the station, for like 20 years. And I've never done a show on Disney.
Really?
And even before we start, even if you make me so angry that I can't stand it, I would like to invite you back sometime in the future to do a show on heroes and superheroes.
That would be great. There's a lot to say in that arena.
Well, hopefully I don't drive you crazy too.
Okay.
So we are going to talk about the history and mysteries of Disney. And I'm going to start with a little bit of early history of Disney. And I want to know what happened to Roy Disney, because people only seem to talk about Walt Disney.
They do. Roy is this pivotal figure, though, in the foundation of the company and the creative vision of what Walt ends up doing. I mean, Walt, we kind of position Walt Disney as sort of the single mind, and he becomes the name on the package. But it's Roy, actually, who was there with Walt from the very beginning. As Roy was watching his brother make inroads into both cinema, early cinema, and early animation, when Walt got his footing and really wanted the company to take off, he brought Roy in a more aggressive fashion. And Roy often gets, you know, sort of shortchanged in the story because he's also the money guy. He's the individual who has to rein in his brother when he goes over budget, when his ideas are too big for what either the studio can handle or what creatively what it can handle in terms of numbers of bodies or what it can financially handle. So it's Roy that's going out and finding corporate partners. It's Roy who's going out and helping get the backing. And he's a key figure to the whole family, and particularly to the development of the company.
So why does Disney become Walt Disney and not Roy and Walt Disney? I mean, it's Oliver and Wilbur Wright. Why isn't it Roy and Walt Disney?
Because I think one of the greatest strengths of Disney is its creative output. Walt was single-minded in many ways of his belief in an artistic and aesthetic vision for animation. And Walt was someone who was in many ways more charismatic than his brother, but so passionate and so eager in a way that could be quite infectious. And if we think about Walt Disney, even though today it's this large, you know, corporation that seems to control so much of media and entertainment. At the time, it was Walt crafting and massaging belief into what he was doing. And he had to have people buy in to that sense of wonder and again, creativity. He was the guy who made that happen. And because we think of Walt Disney and its products in terms of its characters and its narratives, those were all Walt. That was really Walt pushing particular stories and having those stories being converted into animated pictures.
So if we go back to the beginning, one of the first things that really makes Disney popular is the Steamboat Willie,
yes.
Correct?
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
How does Steamboat Willie become Mickey Mouse?
Well, Walt had been toying around with coming up with a new character to define and really sort of shape and contain all of his sorts of energies. He had had a difficult situation with a previous character that he lost the rights to early in his animating career. And the myth, the idea is that he was on a train from one coast to another, and he was trying to think about other characters and what to name them. But there was something really compelling about a mouse, different than a rabbit, different than another sort of animal figure that he wanted to work with and sort of be the core of his sort of his film base and sort of his identity, if you will, and Mickey becomes that. And so by the time Steamboat Willie comes out, you've got Walt centering or focusing on a particular character, which is Mickey. You've got the technological advancements that are put forth by Steamboat Willie and the use of sound and the way sound's employed in that. And you've got something really special. At this point, Walt is doing the voice of Mickey Mouse as well, and he's identifying very closely with this character. So this figure that comes out in the 1930s, right character, right time, and it becomes the centerpiece of the entire company very quickly. Very quickly it does.
You talk about sound. What makes the cartoon so popular?
Well, it has to do with the ways in which you have actual synchronized sound. This was not done in animated pictures and in early cinema. So he offers us the first short, basically film with synchronized sound. And that is transformative. So you see at the same time, you don't have a band or musicians playing in the theater. Rather, you've got all of this recorded at the same time. You've got a beautiful use of sound effects to round out this character as well of Mickey Mouse. That's another key component. Walt understood how sounds and visual gags could and do enrich a character. And when you put those together, when you make it something organic, you can get these figures that are they're almost their own people. They're almost like they're real life. And that's what Mickey becomes.
And how do we go from the name Steamboat Willie to Mickey Mouse?
So he knows, he names, again, legend has it, the name was given to Mickey by, it suggested by his spouse. And Steamboat Willie is a great moment for animation and animation history. But Mickey becomes the marketable face of the company. So quickly after the success of Steamboat Willie and various other shorts, Mickey becomes quickly packageable. Mickey shows up on items and products that people can buy. And that way in which Walt is able to brand Mickey and attach himself to that brand creates a sort of larger, bigger presence in American culture, bigger presence for Walt Disney as well. So Mickey's there. Mickey's this great character in his films. But Mickey, there are other opportunities for Mickey as well. But Mickey is a figure that Walt identified very closely with. Walt thought that he saw in Mickey or felt in Mickey a kind of chutzpah, a kind of spirit that he thought was very admirable. And he saw himself in some of that as well.
You've used the word legend several times. Is there not, there's no biography, there's no actual interview with Walt Disney where he told the true story?
Walt did a lot of interviews. I mean, he is an American legend. He was open with the press about that. Yeah, there are stories about what he thought about Mickey Mouse. Scholars sometimes re-canvass that. We go back over that, not to judge the veracity of it, to determine if it was true or not, but could there have been other influences? Could there have been other aspects that might inform more of Walt's decisions? Yeah, but Walt was very free with the press about talking about Mickey and Mickey's importance. But I'm not quite sure how he would talk about Mickey then as how we kind of want to talk about him today, or it. So it's an it, not a him. Even I think of Mickey Mouse as a character, as a him.
I guess today, Professor Carmen Higginbotham, as we talk about Disney, Professor Higginbotham teaches two Disney classes. What's the difference between the two?
One class is a summer school class that is just focused on Disneyland and the parks. And through that, we go through an understanding of what each land actually means, what Walt was thinking, what were the influences on him to make an amusement park that he's pulling from World's Fairs at the beginning of the century and Coney Island, which he sort of detested, but he wanted to have a better kind of space. So we study all of that, and we study the international parks at the same time. The other course is just called Disney, and that's 15 weeks. And we really examine in that class the intersection of three things about Disney: the man, Walt Disney, the myth of Disney, this entity that lives with us even today, and the company. And when you bring those three things together, you really broaden out your understanding of the cultural footprint of Disney, more so than just looking at pure biography about who Walt was and where he was, you know, where he was born. The myth, just simply the myth of Disney. You have to understand all three to sort of start really breaking apart what it means to us in contemporary culture.
So I'll put you on the spot here. And can you give us, pick one myth?
Well, the sort of the myth of Disney. One of the myths of Disney is that Disney is a family, is consistently about the good of the family. And that Disney as a company and Disney as a man was invested simply in that. That what Disney produces is good, and it's meant to be innocent, and it's meant to be almost pure in a way. And so through the time in my class, we start breaking down what actually does that mean? Whose families to whom is Walt referring? What kinds of families are being promoted? What kinds of behaviors are being celebrated or suppressed? What does it mean for women to be in these kinds of narratives? What does it mean when you have a company and a man who believe very much in innocence, but it has made innocence marketable and is sort of selling innocence? Is innocence the same thing as ignorance? And at what point are Disney's narratives or Disney the man or even the company, you know, sort of negotiating that for a variety of reasons, whether it's promoting a particular kind of cultural vision or to make a gobs of money? You know, those are real questions that one should ask when confronted with Disney. And this is what the classroom allows us to do. It takes a long time. I need the full 15 weeks just to get students, and these are 18 to 21-year-olds just to be able to ask those questions. I tell the students when I teach this class, in some ways, Disney is harder to teach than religion, a religion class. Because when they grew up, they were taught that there were other religions that existed. And whether or not they believe the same ideologies of those religions, they're taught that they exist. And there are other ways to think and believe, and you can position yourself against that. And there are all these scholars weighing in. There is no counter-narrative to Disney. There is no counter-discourse to Disney. It is something they've been raised on since they were small children, and they have been taught not to question it, that there is another narrative besides Disney. There's nothing comparable to it. There's Warner Brothers never reached that height that we see with the Disney Corporation today. You can't really cite any other characters in kids' lives that extend from themselves to back to their parents, back to their grandparents. Disney is something that is largely unquestioned. We are critical of it at times. We can criticize some of the products. Oh, I didn't like that movie. That one wasn't so good. But for the most part, we don't question the ideologies. We don't question the statements that it makes about people, about culture.
Is this a 20-person course or 100?
Oh, this sits at about 35. Because the entire class is discussion, because you have to slowly crack through. I can only do about 35. That's about all we can handle. But eventually in that class, you know, my job is to sort of blow their minds, to get them to think critically. If you can criticize Disney, you can criticize anything. I really do believe that. And if you can do it in a smart way. But it's hard. People are attached. We're very attached.
What was Disney's, Walt and Roy's, I guess, best decision for the company in its earlier history?
Best decision. I would say selling Snow White, getting the backing for Snow White. I think they've had two moments that are critical. Getting the backing for Snow White, pitching that movie when the whole thing was in Walt's head, and then Walt, and with Roy's help, of course, but Walt then finding a few illustrators to work with him and sort of help him mock it up. Walt being able to go through the entire film for his immediate staff, doing the voices, knowing that vision, that was brilliant. And Roy, of course, helping him get that backing, because that really put him on the map in a way that he hadn't experienced before. A feature length animated picture in the 1930s. Are you kidding me? Who's going to go to that? And he made it something really beautiful and emotional, was able to craft this. The other thing was partnering in the early 50s with ABC, so he could get the backing for Disneyland. That was brilliant. Having a television show that was called Disneyland that basically preceded the park. It allowed him to roll out the plans for the park, this idea he had for this space. It allowed him to talk about two audiences in their living rooms about his creative vision for this park. Hands down, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Again, our guest today, Professor Carmen Higginbotham from UVA's McIntyre Department of Art, as we talk about the history and mysteries of Disney. We're mentioning TV. We just have another minute or so before our first break. Joining ABC, what was going on there on the early shows?
Well, his early shows were strictly intended to sort of sell the park and get the backing for the park. And so he partnered with ABC. Of course, the irony being Disney would then own ABC, which is always makes us chuckle as scholars. But those shows were intended to solidify the brand, right, to get Walt in front of faces. But when Walt got in front of faces, what became clear was people wanted to see Walt Disney. They wanted to see the guy who was responsible for some of the films that were transformative in their own childhoods. And Walt is such a likable guy on camera. He is. He's everybody's grandfather.
All right, take our first break. We'll be right back to talk more about Disney World. Hang tight. All right, back in the room as we discuss Disney World with the professor. So back into talking about Disney. So on to the TV. Were they, when TV came into the world of Disney, or Disney came into the world of TV, I'm not sure which which really happened. The Mickey Mouse Club,
right,
starts up.
That's great.
What was going on there? What was the effect into the world, or into certainly the U.S. at the time?
Well, you can think about it a lot of ways. I mean, you can think about it in terms of, you know, now Walt is not only in your living room regularly, but your children are being shaped by, get to see him and experience him. And there are avenues for children to be a part of Disney, even if they cannot go to the parks, even if they, for some reason, aren't able to get to the next feature film. In our society, we keep forgetting, young people do. They forget, as older folks remember, if the movie went out of the movie theater, you just had to wait until they showed it again at the movie theater. There was no opportunity to watch it in the home again. What television allowed Walt to do was stay current and present with his audiences, and even better, to have moments where you could show little snippets or excerpts from his films and re-show them again. Song of the South becomes a great example of that, a film that has a tumultuous experience in the mid-40s when it's released. But then on television, the film is cut up into pieces and Walt can show segments of the film and people can experience his animated products all over again. It's quite wonderful. And it's great at a moment in the 1950s where television is transforming how Americans are defining themselves in an early Cold War period. That idea of galvanizing a sense of who America is post-war, where women are supposed to be, what children are supposed to be, what dads are supposed to be. All that's coming together in the 50s, and Walt's capitalizing on that in the 50s and into the early 60s.
Let's talk about characters for a bit. Because certainly that's, when you go back to Snow White, I mean, we started with Mickey and then you jumped on to Snow White. But here we are today. I'd like you to talk about some of the characters from the beginning through now. And I realize I'm not asking you to talk about all of them, but just the some of the changes. If you talk about Snow White and then Cinderella.
Right.
What happened between the two? To tell me about Cinderella and the importance of Cinderella at the time.
Right. Well, I have to say, for the record, Cinderella is my absolute favorite character. And that's my favorite Disney film of that sort of mid-career sort of golden era of the Disney Corporation. So Snow White, with all of Disney's characters, they very much reflect the era from which they come. They very much speak to the social and cultural conditions of when they are created. So Snow White is a 1930s sort of representation of womanhood and the ideals of perseverance, particularly during a Great Depression. There are many moments where she spends alone. She has to sort of think for herself, but ultimately she's rescued, right, from a death experience, right? You have this great sort of and traumatic ending, which leads to her ultimate happiness, right? That sort of solidification of marriage. It's a very 30s healing kind of narrative. You get to Cinderella, and it doesn't have the same pain that you get in Walt's early pictures. So with Dumbo, with Pinocchio, where there's with Bambi, the sense of violence and pain. And by 1950, Walt is negotiating his presence at the company. He wants to focus on other things, and it would turn out to be his park. And so there's a distance between Walt, the creator, the guy who runs the studio as well, and that film. But Cinderella is the princess paradigm. If you ask individuals, they will say one of the first princesses they encountered, the understanding of the Disney princess, it comes more from Cinderella than it does with Snow White. And Cinderella is a character who has all the markers of a challenging childhood, one could argue victimhood. She is parentless. She is sort of suffering, and she dreams. Her agency, her ability to, you know, sort of her place in the world is defined by her dreaming. And of course, she's a really nice character, too. She takes care of the mice who talk to her and whatever, and tries to make the world a better place. And she never loses that optimism. And that sort of optimism is what will push into all the later princesses. And I think Walt understands by the popularity of Cinderella in 1950, it does well, that there might be something to this princess thing. I can't confirm that, but it seems as though to quickly move into Sleeping Beauty, you start to get a type. And then by the 80s, the corporation, the company is really glommed onto that. And then you have that complete princess push. That's a whole other brand of characters, which is different than your Simbas, your other sorts of Disney characters that don't fall in the princess line. So, no, Cinderella is key in as much as she represents 1950s womanhood in a really, really startling way.
You talk about how they represent their time period. Does Disney sort of take on or take a hard time from some from the culture because they are representing old time old time women and you know, and they need to be more modern and represent more modern women? Women aren't princesses anymore. They don't, you know, make your characters more modern women.
Right, right. When Walt's alive, Walt has the ability to be the individual who gives you traditionalism. I don't think anybody, and even today, Disney is not a radical company. It doesn't put out really radical products. When it's under the pure Disney brand of this is a Disney picture, it'll push boundaries, but it's never been more than a traditional sort of construct. And so in the 50s and 60s, it starts to feel dated by the 60s. And so you have wonderful films like Mary Poppins come up, where she's not a princess, she's a nanny, but she's a tough-as-nails nanny, right? And she's not going to take anybody's guff. And she whips that family into shape, right? That's a film where traditional motherhood has kind of failed, and so you need Mary Poppins to come in.
It's also a live person.
Exactly.
Does that make a difference?
It makes it easier to be radical in a surprising way. It makes it easier also for folks to relate to Mary Poppins. But that's a difficult film also because that's also set in Britain. That is an American film, and that's about American culture. But it's a very crafty move, very smart. Push it in Britain. Put it at, set it at right around the turn of the century. Put it around women's suffrage, which is basically a civil rights movement, to sort of distract and deflect from what's happening in the 60s, which is a women's movement, right, that is calling for more power and agency. It's a great way to shift the cultural debate. And so people see it, and even in the 60s, it's not about America, it's about England, but it's very much about the current moment from which it comes. There are maneuvers like that for Disney, but they're rare. For the most part, our princesses are pretty traditional, and this is where students always come at me. We almost have this, like, sort of contest about, they're like, oh, really, professor? I'm like, oh, let's bring it. And we'll go back and forth between, they'll start naming a contemporary princess, Mulan. And I say, she's not a princess. And they're like, darn it. And then they'll come up with another one, and we'll go each one. But underneath all of those conversations, including Elsa and Anna from Frozen, which always gets me, I get a lot of heat from this, but it's true, are very traditional. There's something about them that that requires a kind of female suffering. You get that from Elsa, that she's in pain the most of the movie. She's unhappy most of the movie. She's the most powerful figure in the entire movie, and she's in an intense amount of pain. And so there's no place for her to be powerful and happy. At the end, she gets that, but it's at the very end. We never see that. We never get to experience that in the time we sit in the screen. All we see is suffering. And those kind of messages are women, power, pain. But you do have gentle maneuvers, right? Trying to make sure your princesses speak more, that they stand up more, that they push against systems. But there's a traditionalism there that always reverts back to similar sorts of messages.
Again, our guest today, Professor Carmen Higginbotham from University of Virginia, as we talk about Disney, teaches a couple classes over there on Disney. How did you get that job?
It's a sweet gig. No, I actually, when I was in college, I took a class on Disney with an esteemed scholar, and I blew it off. I got a horrific grade. I blew it off. I sat in the back. I did the crossword. I was convinced that I was going to get an A because it's Disney. The midterm crushed me. And then I realized, okay, there was a lot more to this than I even thought. And then I swore. And then I got a horrific grade at the end of the semester. And I felt really bad about that because the professor was so passionate. And I always swore if I ever made something of myself, I would revisit this. And then getting to teach American studies at the University of Virginia, it doesn't get any more American cultural study than Disney. And the folks over there said, you run with it. You try it. And it's worked so far. Worked really well.
And this summer, you were telling me, your class that you're teaching is?
The films of Harry Potter. So I'm starting a class on really examining how Potter and power are sort of manifest in the films. How do we see them? So, because there's magical power, there's institutional power, Hogwarts versus Ministry of Magic, there's gendered power. Let's be honest, everybody would be dead without Hermione. What does that mean that they have that in there? There's the power of knowledge. What secrets are kept for Harry and why? Clearly, Dumbledore knows everything that's going to happen, and yet, he dispenses that information and keeps Harry on the hook in some ways. And, you know, getting students to think about these texts that they've things that they've seen repeatedly and how they have an impact on the way they read culture.
So I have titled the show The History and Mysteries of Disney. So can you tell us a mystery of Disney that many people don't know of?
Well, you know, there's a lot of mystery around who Walt was. Not so much the facts, you know, him being from Missouri, him working very hard, having that standard Midwestern story of by luck and pluck, he's going to make this company work. There's a lot of questions about how he truly felt about women, about race, about Jewish people. There's a lot of mystery about was he anti-Semitic? What does that mean for his labor practices? What does that mean for the cultural products he put out? And those types of things. So I think it's more centered around the man. I think the mystery about Disney's cultural footprint is also really big. What does it mean that we grew up on Disney? Like, who have we become based on those narratives? The happily ever afters, the narratives where everybody's missing a parent, either one or both. Does great joy have to come from such significant loss? What do these films maybe say about America? We just don't know. And we continue to welcome Disney into our lives, and we don't know what effect it's having on us. I think that's a big mystery. It's a big mystery for scholars, definitely. Definitely.
In a way, I'm just throwing these questions at you, and you're doing such a great job. I want the listeners to know I didn't give you this list for you to be prepared with. Professor Carmen Higginbotham here today as we talk about Disney. So we were talking about female characters.
Yes.
So where is like Elastigirl.
I know.
So into this because the movie just came out.
Saw it yesterday.
And Cinderella.
Right.
To Elastigirl.
Right. How do those two even get in the same room?
Right.
Right. One would argue, and this is my argument, not everybody holds to it, but I feel pretty confident about it. One of the things we have to remember is that the Incredibles and Toy Story, those are Pixar films. And Disney would acquire Pixar. They were not originally, Pixar wasn't born out of Disney. And so there's an autonomy to Pixar and the kinds of narratives that it offers. And that's why when sometimes you see a Pixar film, you think, this is nothing like a Disney. I wasn't expecting this at all. That's because they creatively push in a different direction. They've always maintained that. So that would be my argument for why, in part, why they're so different. But I, from a business standpoint, you could argue Disney's brilliant. You know, our visions of women are, should be, need to be in media, complicated. They need to be multifaceted. Disney, in part, knows this. It knows that we all love superheroes. It knows that it can, as a company, weather representations of strong women who have jobs, who, you know, have superhero babies, who can do all of it, as she does, as the main character does. But we still have a place in our heart for Cinderella. They just made the live action Cinderella is not that long ago. And then the live action Beauty and the Beast. And then they're making more live action films, revisiting these earlier narratives. I think they know we love those stories and that part of us is willing to default back into that sort of vision of happiness and female, supposed female happiness, no matter how flawed. One has to question if we hadn't already been fed Disney's understanding of princesses and female happiness at such an early age, would we even be buying into it now? You could argue we've been taught to really revere those female representations, and we're never going to give those up. I don't think the princesses are going anywhere. No matter how often Disney looks at itself and critiques itself, or seems to, no matter how many times it seems like it's making fun of its own princesses. Still the bread and butter. It's still the cash cow. It's still, you know, what audiences want to see. They want to have breakfast with the princesses when they go to Disney World. Little girls buy and boys buy the costumes. They want to be a part of that. They visit the castle. So people think the castle is the most magical place on earth when they go to the park. We're not willing to give that up, that gendered representation. Not just yet.
Professor Carmen Higginbotham here as we talk about Disney. Professor is at UVA's McIntyre Department of Art. So we've been spending a lot of time talking about the movies. Let's talk about the resorts, the properties. Which is more important now? Is it the properties, always the movies?
That's a great question. The properties give you the real experience, the life experience. And I think that for some people, it is the properties. They have to go. There are folks who go every year. They go multiple times a year. They track their personal events, the major milestones in their lives, through and by a visit to one of the Disney parks. That is incredible that one could link getting married or the return of a loved one from military service or the best family experience they have ever had in their entire life on a Disney property. So I think for some, it definitely is having that physical contact, being able to meet the princesses, being able to walk the park, walk through the castle. They have to have that tangible relationship to Disney. It's really cool. It's really cool. Problematic and cool at the same time.
All right, we're going to take our a quick break. We'll be right back. Talk more about Disney. Hang tight. All right, we're back with the professor. Is there a Disney character named the Professor? Is that in the Incredibles?
Which is a Pixar. But it's now under the Disney brand. I can't think of if there is a Professor there, but I'm sure there is a Professor someplace.
But that sounds like a villain. Though.
Yeah, it does. I hope so.
Please don't act villainous during the remaining part of today's program as we talk about the history and mysteries of Disney. Professor Higginbotham, you talked about families and their talking about their moments when going to a Disney resort. I am good friends with a family. I refer to them now as the four-generation family taking their trips. So I got them to make some notes for me on their trips to Disney, and I wanted to sort of share them with you and with listeners today. So it started out, it was just two generations, a mother and father and their three kids back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Early 70s to Disney World. And they referred to it as the magical place, the first family vacation that wasn't a vacation to see family members. Mm-hmm. Then they took the next generation when they were kids.
Right.
So the three kids, when somebody started having kids, and it became three generations to go. After the patriarch died, the matriarch took all three generations back to Disney. Then the matriarch passed away this year, and not wanting to be home when her birthday would come around, her son, age 48 or so, and his wife went to spend that time period in Disney.
Hmm.
He didn't want to be around her house when her birthday was going to come up. He didn't want to be there. Some members of the entire family, they've been to Tokyo Disney, they've been to Euro Disney, and they've been to Disneyland.
Nice.
One of the family members has had Disney music played when she walked down the aisle.
Yes.
One of the daughters, second generation, cried the first time she got to take her son and he saw the entrance.
Right. I could see that.
And then you've mentioned the phrase cultural footprint, which would be the countrywide, so U.S. is the surprise trip to Disney.
Oh, those commercials are the best, too, when you see them.
And so one of the third generation parents has a surprise trip planned for the fourth generation kids.
You're not giving this away, are you?
No.
Okay.
The fourth generation kids are like 5 years old.
Okay.
And they're planning next year to take the fourth generation kids who've never been to Disney yet.
Oh, that's what the parks are. You re-experience not just your first time going, but you get to live someone else's first time going again. You get sort of this double sensation of happiness and joy and nostalgia. It's all sort of smooshing together in this wonderful sort of relived moment. And you're forging memories. Disney wants you to forge memories. Disney wants you to feel as though that your understanding of family, one of the key components of family, is having a past and a happy present. And Disneyland gives you that, right? You're creating memories. You know you're actively, you're accessing your own memories. You're telling stories about when you were at the park, what you bought and what you saw. You maybe get out your ears that everybody has. I have ears. Everybody has ears. They should, and then they go to the park. And then they know that bond is created with their own child or grandchildren, and that they will continue that. It's beautiful. It's brilliant.
I didn't include that, but that reminds me of something that one of the four-generation family members said, was that when somebody in the third generation was really young, the second, and she wanted a Cinderella tiara, or what would she wear? But the second generation kid ran across the park to buy that for her and brought it back, and she still has that. And that would have been 25 years ago.
Of all the items she could have kept in her interaction, of all the things in all of her life, that is a key memory, and that object matters. When I say it's brilliant and when I say it's beautiful, I mean in large part it's, and not to discount the memory and the power of those memories, but that beauty of it is how beautifully this is all structured and created by Disney. I'm a fan, but I'm also a pretty serious critic of Disney and what it offers. And there is something, gosh, dare I say magical? There is something really mindful about wanting people to have those experiences, to make memories, to think of family. That is all generated. That is not happenstance. That didn't just, you know, that's not just this family or one family or 20. These are millions upon millions of people who have been taught to think that way. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's just, but there is a constructed nature to that. That's really fascinating, and how seamless it is. That's something that's very beautiful about Disney.
Sounds like they got the best marketers in the country when it was time to start.
Marketers, but also, you know, tapping into things we all want and believe in. You know, we all want to be loved. We all want to be protected. We all want to believe that we have a cadre of individuals that have our back, right? Family and friends. Even if they're fuzzy little furry friends, they're going to protect you. We want to believe that if you keep believing, good things will happen for you. That's very much a part of our understanding of the American dream, which is this larger idea that we interrogate in American studies, but also a larger idea that we very much hold to. Walt was able to key into our basic desires as human beings and our fears and our wants, and then find a way to give that to us, first in films and animated pictures and now in spaces and places.
Disney has changed, though. They sell alcohol now,
which is surprising.
In the Magic Kingdom.
Well, and think about what it says when we say, wow, Disney sells alcohol now. Most spaces do these things normally and have for a long time. Places that are family friendly, places that we feel comfortable going at any age. Disney gets wonderful credit for doing these maneuvers that seem really forward-thinking, like, wow, they're doing this. And I don't know what year they started allowing alcohol. Like, I couldn't say, but it hasn't been that long. I'm not sure, but I don't know. But, wow, they're doing it, say, in the 21st century. Let's just pick something random. A lot of places were doing it a lot sooner, and a lot of companies would have been under if they hadn't. Yet Disney was able to maintain, again, a kind of cultural reserve, a kind of traditionalism, a word that I've used repeatedly. And we all said it was okay. It's what Disney believed in, even if it maybe wasn't the smartest business practice. It still worked for us. We kept going. That's how they work. They move forward and they get credit for moving forward, but they could have done it a lot sooner. And that's the same thing with their characters, the messages that they offer, sort of that those women who seem so strong, having the first African-American Disney princess in the 2000s and getting press for that being so revolutionary. They could have done it a lot sooner, but they didn't. So why do they get so much credit for finally doing it in the 21st century? When they could have done it sooner? It's an interesting rub, like what we let Disney get away with. And there's a lot. We let them do what they do because they give us what we believe is joy and happiness and family and memories.
So how many times have you been down to, which Disney parks have you been to?
I've been to Disneyland once, Disney World twice. And I took my kids the second time I went to Disney World.
Did you dress up as anything?
No, but I have ears. I got them from Disneyland. I went back in college. It was a long time ago. And then Disney World. No, but as soon as I hit the ground, I was like, I have to get to the castle. I've got to get to the castle. I sprinted to the castle. I bought a Rice Krispie treat because it said it was made with magic. So I went ahead and spent $9 on that. Right. My husband thought I was insane, but I said, but it says it's made with magic. How can I turn this down? I still have the wrapper in my office. I have keychains. I have Disney logos on my credit cards. I've got mugs. I've got all sorts of things.
I mean, I had to ask if you got dressed up. Because my understanding is that you put on some superhero garb when you went to DragonCon in Atlanta.
Yes, yeah, so I've been to DragonCon, and if you go to DragonCon, everybody cosplays. That's part of the glory of DragonCon, as opposed to Comic-Con in California. But no, not at Disney. There are pros there, man. They know what they're doing. You got wonderful interns and college students dressed up as your favorite Disney princesses. You get to meet and greet the characters. You get to shake their hands. You get to have them sign, it was not that long ago where they actually signed their autographs and books. You get to, as I mentioned, have breakfast with them. You get to be in a Disney experience.
Well, the family, the four-generation family, and they still go, and they... I don't know what it's called. I can't remember what it's called, where you get to sit or you get to stay in certain parts of the resort to let you go in earlier and stay later than the folks who just drive up and buy tickets.
I've heard of this. It's part of one of the packages I think you can get.
And you get to take the monorail in rather than having to drive and park.
Right. It allows, I think, a more immersive experience. But right. I've heard of it. I've
exactly.
never done it.
Yeah.
It can be pricey.
Talk for a minute. We just have a few minutes left again with Professor Higginbotham as we talk about Disney. Disney's attempt to be in the middle, to appeal to everyone,
right,
makes it difficult to make some decisions. You know, they, with owning ABC mm-hmm. and then the Roseanne Barr issue, mm-hmm. can you talk about that for a moment?
Well, I think it is a company that has weathered quite a bit in its history. Whether or not its contemporary situations, such as the Roseanne Barr, I don't want to call it a scandal, but definitely all the press that surrounded that. It had that back in the 40s. It had that back at certain moments when it put forth a particular social agenda that was beaten back or was felt wasn't being respectful. So it knows how to do this. I think Disney is a diversified company now, to the point where we don't even really appreciate how much it owns, how many corporate partners it has, what companies it does own. Folks think they're reading the Percy Jackson series, kids do, and they're surprised to find out that that's, that book, that publisher is owned by Disney, or how much of a stake Disney has in Hulu, or how much, where and when are they feeling those sorts of pressures. I think because it's so diversified, it can weather what happened with the Roseanne Barr situation. And there's a way in which they're very good at separating their subsidiaries and their companies from the identity of Disney. I think that ABC has recently been in a pickle and has had to negotiate some things. But we typically don't assign those problems and that controversy to my trip to Disneyland or Disney World. That's completely separated out. That's that's smart business, if you think about it. They're very good that way. They're very good that way.
How does Disney appeal universally? I mean, when you have Disney World, but then you have Euro Disney.
Right. And you've got a new park that opened up recently in China. They had Shanghai, but then they opened another one. There are so many Disney opportunities now. You're exporting American culture. That's what you're doing. I mean,
Euro Disney didn't work that well in the beginning, correct?
Oh, no. Back when it was Disneyland Paris, I think it was originally called, or Paris Disneyland. No. And some areas in some regions of the world are more comfortable with the exportation of American culture. And France, not so much. And so they had to find a way to work with local communities to make that a functioning product for those environments. And it sounds very cold because I keep talking about it in terms of products. I'm realizing this. But that's in large part what they are. Disney's not going to build a park where it can't make money off of it. It's not going to stay there unless it can. And different characters have a different prominence in different parks, but it's very much a kind of promoting Walt's idea of these core values of family and memories and innocence, magic, that he's able to sort of share around the world.
And how does Disney do this, whether you're in the United States or out of the United States, and do this modern day with a security needed and still make you feel like a wanted, please come into our hearts, please come into our homes?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question. Do you mean?
Well, you know, if I'm going to search you and make sure you're not bringing anything dangerous into our world, but hi, this is Cinderella next to you.
And she wants to hug you and take your picture.
Right.
Again, this is a place that is committed itself to having you have a whole sort of experience about Disney without you worrying about the real world. That's what Disney does. And so any security measures that the parks are taking, they're all hidden from you. You don't realize how many cameras are there, how much security force is there, and the ways in which they are monitoring guests and making sure everybody is safe, right? They've been doing this sort of activity for so long of creating a magical space that I'm sure behind the scenes they have an aggressive sort of security force to make sure guests are safe. But that's not what we should be worried about, right? Disney is about a kind of safety, emotional and physical. And they, again, this is practiced behaviors and practices, if you will, for this company. They're able to do it.
I had a fabulous hour.
I had a good time. Thank you so much for the invitation.
All right. Everybody, Professor Carmen Higginbotham, UVA's McIntyre Department of Art. I don't know if you can get in her class. Sign up and see if there's any room. All right. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.